Chapter 29, Nestorius of Antioch promoted to the See of Constantinople. His persecution of the heretics. After the death of Sisinnius, on account of the spirit of ambitious rivalry displayed by the ecclesiastics of Constantinople, the emperors resolved that none of that church should fill the vacant bishopric, notwithstanding the fact that many eagerly desired to have Philip ordained, and no less a number were in favor of the election of Priclus. They therefore sent for a stranger, one from Antioch, whose name was Nestorius, to a native of Germanicia, three distinguished for his excellent voice and fluency of speech, qualifications which they judged important for the instruction of the people. After 3 months had elapsed, therefore, Nestorius was brought from Antioch, being greatly lauded by some for his temperance. But what sort of a disposition he was of in other respects, those who possessed any discernment were able to perceive from his first sermon, being ordained on the 10th of April, under the consulate of Felix and Taurus, for he immediately uttered those famous words, before all the people, in addressing the emperor, "Give me, my prince, the earth purged of heretics, and I will give you heaven as a recompense. Assist me in destroying heretics, and I will assist you in vanquishing the Persians." 5. Now, although these utterances were extremely gratifying to some of the multitude, who cherished a senseless antipathy to the very name of heretic, yet those, as I have said, who were skillful in predicating a man's character from his expressions, did not fail to detect his levity of mind, and violent and vainglorious temperament, inasmuch as he had burst forth into such vehemence without being able to contain himself for even the shortest space of time, and to use the proverbial phrase, before he had tasted the water of the city, showed himself a furious persecutor. Accordingly, on the fifth day after his ordination, having determined to demolish a chapel in which the Arians were accustomed to perform their devotions privately, he drove these people to desperation, for when they saw the work of destruction going forward in their chapel, they threw fire into it, and the fire spreading on all sides reduced many of the adjacent buildings also to ashes. A tumult accordingly arose on account of this throughout the city, and the Arians, burning to revenge themselves, made preparations for that purpose. But God, the guardian of the city, suffered not the mischief to gather to a climax. From that time, however, they branded Nestorius as an incendiary, and it was not only the heretics who did this, but those also of his own faith. For he could not rest, but seeking every means of harassing those who embraced not his own sentiments, he continually disturbed the public tranquillity. He annoyed the Novatians also, being incited to jealousy because Paul their bishop was everywhere respected for his piety, but the emperor by his admonitions checked his fury. With what calamities he visited the Quarto Decimans throughout Asia, Lydia, and Caria, and what multitudes perished in a popular tumult of which he was the cause at Miletus and Sardis, I think proper to pass by in silence. What punishment he suffered for all these enormities, and for that unbridled license of speech in which he indulged himself, I shall mention somewhat later. 6. Chapter 30. The Burgundians embrace Christianity under Theodosius the Younger. I must now relate an event well worthy of being recorded, which happened about this time. There is a barbarous nation dwelling beyond the Rhine, denominated Burgundians. They lead a peaceful life, for being almost all artisans, they support themselves by the exercise of their trades. The Huns, by making continual eruptions on this people, devastated their country, and often destroyed great numbers of them. In this perplexity, therefore, the Burgundians resolved to have recourse not to any human being, but to commit themselves to the protection of some god, and having seriously considered that the god of the Romans mightily defended those that feared him, they all with common consent embraced the faith of Christ. Going therefore to one of the cities of Gaul, they requested the bishop to grant them Christian baptism, who ordering them to fast 7 days, and having meanwhile instructed them in the elementary principles of the faith, on the eighth day baptized and dismissed them. Accordingly, becoming confident thenceforth, they marched against their invaders, nor were they disappointed in their hope. For the king of the Huns, up to one by name, having died in the night from the effects of a surfeit, The Burgundians attacked that people then without a commander-in-chief, and although they were few in numbers and their opponents very many, they obtained a complete victory, for the Burgundians were altogether but 3,000 men, and destroyed no less than 10,000 of the enemy. From that period this nation became zealously attached to the Christian religion. About the same time Barbas, bishop of the Arians, died, on the 24th of June, under the 13th consulate of Theodosius, II and the 3rd of Valentinian, and Sabatius was constituted his successor. Enough has been said of these matters. Chapter 31, Nestorius harasses the Macedonians. Nestorius indeed acted contrary to the usage of the church, and caused himself to be hated in other ways also, one as is evident from what happened during his episcopate. For Antony, bishop of Juma, a city of the Hellespont, actuated by the example of Nestorius in his intolerance of heretics, began to persecute the Macedonians, under the pretext of carrying out the intentions of the patriarch. The Macedonians for some time endured his annoyance, but when Antony proceeded to farther extremities, unable any longer to bear his harsh treatment, they were led to a sad desperation, and suborning two men, who put fight in a secondary place and profit first, they assassinated their tormentor. When the Macedonians had perpetrated this crime, Nestorius took occasion from it to increase his violence of conduct against them, and prevailed on the emperor to take away their churches. They were therefore deprived of not only those which they possessed at Constantinople, before the old walls of the imperial city, but of those also which they had at Cyzicus, and many others that belonged to them in the rural districts of the Hellespont. Many of them therefore at that time came over to the Catholic Church, and professed the Homoousian faith. But as the proverb says, drunkards never want wine, nor the contentious strife, and so it fell out with regard to Nestorius, who after having exerted himself to expel others from the church, was himself ejected on the following account. Chapter 32, of the presbyter Anastasius, by whom the faith of Nestorius was perverted. Nestorius had an associate whom he had brought from Antioch, a presbyter named Anastasius. For this man he had the highest esteem, and consulted him in the management of his most important affairs. This Anastasius, preaching one day in the church, said, "Let no one call Mary Theotokos, one, for Mary was but a woman, two, and it is impossible that God should be born of a woman." These words created a great sensation, and troubled many both of the clergy and laity, they having been heretofore taught to acknowledge Christ as God, and by no means to separate his humanity from his divinity on account of the economy of incarnation, heeding the voice of the apostle when he said, "Yea, though we have known Christ after the flesh, yet now henceforth know we him no more." 3 And again, "Wherefore, leaving the word of the beginning of Christ, let us go on unto perfection." For while great offense was taken in the church, as we have said, at what was thus propounded, Nestorius, eager to establish Anastasius's proposition, for he did not wish to have the man who was esteemed by himself found guilty of blasphemy, delivered several public discourses on the subject, in which he assumed a controversial attitude, and totally rejected the epithet Theotokos. Wherefore the controversy on the subject being taken in one spirit by some and in another by others, the discussion which ensued divided the church, and resembled the struggle of combatants in the dark, all parties uttering the most confused and contradictory assertions. Nestorius thus acquired the reputation among the masses of asserting the blasphemous dogma that the Lord is a mere man, and attempting to foist on the church the dogmas of Paul of Samosata and Photinus, and so great a clamour was raised by the contention that it was deemed requisite to convene a general council to take cognizance of the matter in dispute. Having myself perused the writings of Nestorius, I have found him an unlearned man, and shall candidly express the conviction of my own mind concerning him, and as in entire freedom from personal antipathies, I have already alluded to his faults, I shall in like manner be unbiased by the criminations of his adversaries, to derogate from his merits. I cannot then concede that he was either a follower of Paul of Samosata or of Photinus, or that he denied the divinity of Christ, but he seemed scared at the term Theotokos, as though it was some terrible phantom. The fact is, the causeless alarm he manifested on this subject just exposed his extreme ignorance, for being a man of natural fluency as a speaker, he was considered well-educated, but in reality he was disgracefully illiterate. In fact, he contemned the drudgery of an accurate examination of the ancient expositors, and, puffed up with his readiness of expression, he did not give his attention to the ancients, but thought himself the greatest of all. Now he was evidently unacquainted with the fact that in the first Catholic epistle of John it was written in the ancient copies, 6 Every spirit that separates Jesus is not of God. The mutilation of this passage 7 is attributable to those who desired to separate the divine nature from the human economy, or to use the very language of the early interpreters, some persons have corrupted this epistle, aiming at separating the manhood of Christ from his deity. But the humanity is united to the divinity in the Savior, so as to constitute not two persons but one only. Hence it was that the ancients, emboldened by this testimony, scrupled not to style Mary Theotokos. For thus Eusebius Pamphilus in his third book of the Life of Constantine 8 writes in these terms, "And in fact God with us submitted to be born for our sake, and the place of his nativity is by the Hebrews called Bethlehem. Wherefore the devout Empress Helena adorned the place of accouchement of the God-bearing Virgin with the most splendid monuments, decorating that sacred spot with the richest ornaments." Origen also in the first volume of his commentaries on the Apostles' Epistle to the Romans, gives an ample exposition of the sense in which the term Theotokos is used. It is therefore obvious that Nestorius had very little acquaintance with the treatises of the ancients, and for that reason, as I observed, objected to the word only, for that he does not assert Christ to be a mere man, as Photinus did or Paul of Samosata. His own published homilies fully demonstrate. In these discourses he nowhere destroys the proper personality 20 of the Word of God, but on the contrary invariably maintains that he has an essential and distinct personality and existence. Nor does he ever deny his subsistence as Photinus and the Samosatan did, and as the Manichaeans and followers of Montanus have also dared to do. Such in fact I find Nestorius, both from having myself read his own works, and from the assurances of his admirers. But this idle contention of his has produced no slight ferment in the religious world. Chapter 33, Desecration of the Altar of the Great Church by Runaway Slaves. While matters were in this state, it happened that an outrage was perpetrated in the church. For the domestics of a man of quality who were foreigners, having experienced harsh treatment from their master, fled from him to the church, and thus they ran up to the very altar with their swords drawn. One nor could they be prevailed upon by any entreaties to withdraw, so that they impeded the performance of the sacred services, but inasmuch as they obstinately maintained their position for several days, brandishing their weapons in defiance of anyone who dared to approach them and in fact killed one of the ecclesiastics, and wounded another, they were finally compelled to slay themselves. A person who was present at this desecration of the sanctuary remarked that such a profanation was an ominous presage, and in support of his view of the matter, quoted the two following iambics of an ancient poet: "For such prognostics happen at a time when temples are defiled by impious crime." Nor was he who made the prediction disappointed in these inauspicious forebodings, for they signified, as it seems, a division among the people, and the deposition of the author of it. Chapter 34, Synod at Ephesus against Nestorius, his deposition. Nor long time elapsed before a mandate from the emperor directed the bishops in all places to assemble at Ephesus. One immediately after the festival of Easter, therefore, Nestorius, escorted by a great crowd of his adherents, repaired to Ephesus, and found many of the bishops already there. Cyril, bishop of Alexandria, making some delay, did not arrive till near Pentecost. 5 days after Pentecost, Juvenal, bishop of Jerusalem, arrived. While John of Antioch was still absent, those who were now congregated entered into the consideration of the question, and Cyril of Alexandria began a sharp skirmish of words, with the design of terrifying Nestorius, for he had a strong dislike for him. When many had declared that Christ was God, Nestorius said, I cannot term him God who was 2 and 3 months old. I am therefore clear of your blood, and shall in future come no more among you. Having uttered these words he left the assembly, and afterwards held meetings with the other bishops who entertained sentiments similar to his own. Accordingly those present were divided into two factions. That section which supported Cyril, having constituted themselves a council, summoned Nestorius, but he refused to meet them, and put them off until the arrival of John of Antioch. The partisans of Cyril therefore proceeded to the examination of the public discourses of Nestorius which he had preached on the subject in dispute, and after deciding from a repeated perusal of them that they contained distinct blasphemy against the Son of God, they deposed him. This being done, the partisans of Nestorius constituted themselves another council apart, and therein deposed Cyril himself, and together with him Memnon bishop of Ephesus. Not long after these events, John bishop of Antioch made his appearance, and being informed of what had taken place, he pronounced unqualified censure on Cyril as the author of all this confusion, in having so precipitately proceeded to the deposition of Nestorius. Upon this Cyril combined with Juvenal to revenge themselves on John, and they deposed him also. When affairs reached this confused condition, Nestorius saw that the contention which had been raised was thus tending to the destruction of communion. In bitter regret he called Mary Theotokos, and cried out, "Let Mary be called Theotokos, if you will, and let all disputing cease." But although he made this recantation, no notice was taken of it, for his deposition was not revoked, and he was banished to the oasis, where he still remains. To such was the conclusion of this synod. These things were done on the 28th of June, under the consulate of Bassus and Antiochus. 3 John, when he had returned to his bishopric, having convened several bishops, deposed Cyril, who had also returned to his see, but soon afterwards, having set aside their enmity and accepting each other as friends, they mutually reinstated each other in their episcopal chairs. But after the deposition of Nestorius a mighty agitation prevailed through the churches of Constantinople, for the people was divided on account of what we have already called his unfortunate utterances, and the clergy unanimously anathematized him. For such is the sentence which we Christians are accustomed to pronounce on those who have advanced any blasphemous doctrines, when we set up their impiety that it may be publicly exposed, as it were, on a pillar, to universal execration. Chapter 35, Maximian elected to the episcopate of Constantinople, though some wished Proclus to take that place. After this there was another debate concerning the election of a bishop of Constantinople. Many were in favor of Philip, of whom we have already made mention, but a still greater number advocated the claims of Proclus. And the candidacy of Proclus would have succeeded, had not some of the most influential persons interfered, on the ground of its being forbidden by the ecclesiastical canon that a person nominated to one bishopric should be translated to that of another city. 1 The people believing this assertion were thereby restrained, and about 4 months after the deposition of Nestorius, a man named Maximian was promoted to the bishopric, who had lived an ascetic life, and was also ranked as a presbyter. He had acquired a high reputation for sanctity, on account of having at his own expense constructed sepulchral depositories for the reception of the pious after their decease, but was rude in speech too and inclined to live a quiet life. Chapter 36, The author's opinion of the validity of translations from one see to another. But since some parties, by appealing to a prohibition in the ecclesiastical canon, prevented the election of Proclus, because of his previous appointment to the see of Cyzicus, I wish to make a few remarks on this subject. Those who then presumed to interpose such a cause of exclusion do not appear to me to have stated the truth, but they were either influenced by prejudice against Proclus, or at least have been themselves completely ignorant both of the canons, and of the frequent and often advantageous precedents that had been established in the churches. Eusebius Pamphilus relates in the 6th book of his Ecclesiastical History, 1 that Alexander, bishop of a certain city in Cappadocia, coming to Jerusalem for devotional purposes, was detained by the inhabitants of that city, and constituted bishop, as the successor of Narcissus, and that he continued to preside over the churches there during the remainder of his life. So indifferent a thing was it amongst our ancestors, to transfer a bishop from one city to another as often as it was deemed expedient. But if it is necessary to place beyond a doubt the falsehood of the statement of those who prevented the ordination of Proclus, I shall annex to this treatise the canon bearing on the subject. It runs thus: 2. If any one after having been ordained a bishop should not proceed to the church unto which he has been appointed, from no fault on his part, but either because the people are unwilling to receive him, or for some other reason arising from necessity, let him be partaker of the honor and functions of the rank with which he has been invested, provided he intermeddles not with the affairs of the church wherein he may minister. It is his duty, however, to submit to whatever the synod of the province may see fit to determine, after it shall have taken cognizance of the matter. Such is the language of the canon. That many bishops have been transferred from one city to another to meet the exigencies of peculiar cases, I shall now prove by giving the names of those bishops who have been so translated. Perigens was ordained bishop of Patre, but inasmuch as the inhabitants of that city refused to admit him, the bishop of Rome directed that he should be assigned to the metropolitan see of Corinth, which had become vacant by the decease of its former bishop. Here he presided during the rest of his days. Gregory was first made bishop of Sasima, one of the cities of Cappadocia, but was afterwards transferred to Natsiensis. Militius, after having presided over the church at Sebastia, subsequently governed that of Antioch. Alexander, bishop of Antioch, transferred Dositheus, bishop of Seleucia, to Tarsus in Cilicia. Reverentius was removed from Area in Phoenicia, and afterwards to Tyre. John was transferred from Gorgium, a city of Lydia, to Proconissus, and presided over the church there. Palladius was transferred from Helenopolis to Aspuna, and Alexander from the same city to Adriani. Theophilus was removed from Apama in Asia to Eudoxopolis, anciently called Salumbria. Polycarp was transferred from Saxantipristor, a city of Mysia, to Nicopolis in Thrace. Hierophilus from Trapezopolis in Phrygia to Platinopolis in Thrace. Optimus from Magdamia in Phrygia to Antioch in Pisidia, and Silvanus from Philippopolis in Thrace to Troas. This enumeration of bishops who have passed from one see to another is sufficient for the present. Concerning Silvanus, who was removed from Philippopolis in Thrace to Troas, I deem it desirable here to give a concise account. Chapter 37, Miracle performed by Silvanus, bishop of Troas, formerly of Philippopolis. Silvanus was formerly a rhetorician, and had been brought up in the school of Troilus the Sophist. But aiming at perfection in his Christian course, he entered on the ascetic mode of life, and set aside the rhetorician's pallium. Atticus, bishop of Constantinople, having taken notice of him, afterwards ordained him bishop of Philippopolis. One thus he resided 3 years in Thrace, but being unable to endure the cold of that region, for his constitution was delicate and sickly, he begged Atticus to appoint someone else in his place, alleging that it was for no other reason but the cold that he resigned residence in Thrace. This having been done, Silvanus resided at Constantinople, where he practiced so great austerities that, despising the luxurious refinements of the age, he often appeared in the crowded streets of that populous city shod with sandals made of hay. Some time having elapsed, the bishop of Troas died, on which account the inhabitants of that city came to Atticus concerning the appointment of a successor. While he was deliberating whom he should ordain for them, Silvanus happened to pay him a visit, which at once relieved him from further anxiety. For addressing Silvanus, he said, "You have now no longer any excuse for avoiding the pastoral administration of a church, for Troas is not a cold place, so that God has considered your infirmity of body, and provided you a suitable residence. Go thither then, my brother, without delay." Silvanus therefore removed to that city. Here a miracle was performed by his instrumentality, which I shall now relate. An immense ship for carrying burdens, such as they term float, too intended for the conveyance of enormous billows, had been recently constructed on the shore at Troas. This vessel it was necessary to launch, but although many strong ropes were attached to it, and the power of a vast number of persons was applied, the vessel was in no way moved. When these attempts had been repeated several days successively with the like result, the people began to think that a devil detained the ship. They therefore went to the bishop Silvanus, and entreated him to go and offer a prayer in that place, for thus only they thought it could be launched. He replied with his characteristic lowliness of mind that he was but a sinner, and that the work pertained to someone who was just and not to himself. Being at length prevailed on by their continued entreaties, he approached the shore, where after having prayed, he touched one of the ropes, and exhorting the rest to vigorous exertion, the ship was by the first pull instantly set in motion, and ran swiftly into the sea. This miracle wrought by the hands of Silvanus stirred up the whole population of the province to piety. But the uncommon worth of Silvanus was manifested in various other ways. Perceiving that the ecclesiastics made a merchandise of the contentions of those engaged in lawsuits, he would never nominate any one of the clergy as judge, but causing the documents of the litigants to be delivered to himself, he summoned to him some pious laymen in whose integrity he had confidence, and committing to him the adjudication of the case, he soon equitably settled all the differences of the litigants, and by this procedure Silvanus acquired for himself great reputation from all classes of persons. We have indeed digressed pretty much from the course of our history in giving this account of Silvanus, but yet it will not, we imagine, be unprofitable. Let us now, however, return to the place from which we departed. Maximian, having been ordained on the 25th of October, under the consulate of Bassus and Antiochus, III, the affairs of the church were reduced to a better ordered and more tranquil condition.